Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of November 8th, 2016. I can't believe it, November 8th. Anyway, this week we're joined by our frequent guest, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. So, D.R., we have been covering, I've said more than once that many of these things that we talk about are kind of ongoing narratives, right? They're stories that are evolving, and they're fascinating because nobody really knows where they're going.
Exactly.
One of the stories that has been evolving now for months, and in my consciousness maybe from mid-summertime on, is the whole question of the Dakota Access Pipeline out in the Dakota and crossing the Missouri River near the Standing Rock Sioux tribal lands, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think this, so there's some big doings going on there, but just to, I think, DR, correct me if I'm wrong, but the, well, hang on, before we even go there, just to remind everybody, Dakota Access Company wants to build a pipeline from the Dakotas down to Illinois. It's going to cross the Missouri River just north of the Standing Rock Sioux's tribal lands. The Standing Rock Sioux oppose the pipeline because it threatens their water, and it goes through the sacred burial grounds, right? And so they don't want it. Over the past few weeks, the federal government has stopped construction on federal land through the Corps of Engineers, but the construction continues on the privately held land. One of the Indian tribes utilized what they call the Treaty of 1851, which is between nations, sovereign nations, was a treaty that they claim allowed them to build a campground on top of where the pipeline was going to go. So you had a direct confrontation. And my understanding is the police came in heavy-handedly and cleared everybody out. Right, DR? Did I get that story right?
Yes. Police have just been engaging in just what term can be used to describe it? Just this sort of extreme violence. There are reports of, you know, use of pepper spray, use of just all sorts of violence. Dozens of arrests against the protesters, and just
141 people arrested. Clearing out that camp.
And essentially an effort by the governor of North Dakota to essentially eliminate all traces of protest from North Dakota. Just this sort of attempt to sort of smash down and squash any sort of protests. I mean, I was thinking as you watch this stuff, I grew up, I was about like 11 or 12 years old. You ever see those images from Tiananmen Square? And maybe that's an inexact comparison, but when we looked at Tiananmen Square, we thought, how could a government do that? How could something like that happen? And now, again, maybe it's not the exact same thing, but you're seeing this sort of violence, repression. Bill McKibben has made the comparison to, Bull Connor and what Bull Connor did in the 60s. Just this vicious aggression on the part of law enforcement against people who just want to protect drinking water.
I think that the reports suggest that the police response is quite militarized. It has lots of five different states have brought in their state policemen to help out. I was going to say to your point about sort of the violence, it's psychological violence, not just against journalists, but there was some report, and I probably won't be able to find the link, so I would tread carefully. They were like strip searching the people they arrested and leaving them basically naked in their cells for extended periods of time, right?
Yes.
That's psychological warfare to try and humiliate the people who are in. So when you say that the police response, from what I've seen, is over the top, I think that's fair. That's a fair thing.
Yeah, there have been reports of protesters being held in essentially the equivalent of dog kennels. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just this gruesome stuff. And sadly, unfortunately, as we've talked about before, not a lot of coverage in the press. And one of the reasons why there isn't a lot of coverage in the press is if you've been covering DSmog blog, they've talked about some of the entities that have been financing the Dakota Access Pipeline. Two of those entities are known to, we don't have to get into specific names, but anybody can look it up if they go on DSmog blog. Two of those entities are known to be heavy advertisers on our cable news broadcasts. So you begin to wonder why cable news doesn't seem to be terribly interested in covering this story.
But this stuff is all over social media, right?
Yes.
If you want to find it, you can get all kinds. And it's actually, I mean, it's an object lesson in making sure you believe the website that is making the reports, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's a good education. But you can find all kinds of... I mean, there was one story that I heard of, an unfortunate story, where one of the women protesters had a pistol. And somehow they tried to arrest her. She pulled out the gun. And, of course, that then becomes a justification for further clamping down. Right. Mm-hmm. Nobody's saying that you know, anyone should have a gun as they're being arrested. Fine. But it's not an excuse to come down heavier on the rest of the people that are there. So I don't know. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I want to amend something I just said. I said it was a DSmog blog. It was actually the Democracy Now! Website that'll have the list of the various entities that are said to have been financing the Dakota Access Pipeline. And when you look at those names, you can pretty much figure out how heavily they advertise on our cable news. And you begin to realize that were it not for independent news entities like Democracy Now! And were it not for, frankly, Facebook Live, we wouldn't know about this. It was on Facebook Live that the actress Shailene Woodley recorded her own arrest, and she famously said, "I hope you're watching mainstream media," knowing, of course, that mainstream media wasn't watching.
Well, I think so. If all this stuff going on between ostensibly peaceful Native Americans defending their water supply, basically, the bottom line is their water supply from being put under risk. And you have this with they're all arrested, come in heavy-handed police presence, 141 arrests, take them all away. You know, lines of aggressive-looking policemen facing off against, you know, Indians on horses, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, you go translate yourself 600 or 700 miles west to the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, right, where we had a bunch of, I have to admit, entitled white
yahoos
who took over the federal property. And the police let them come and have a press conference every day. You know, they're sending in food. The guys could, these yahoos could drive around in cars. And of course, what happened, Pat? You tell me, dear, I can barely spit it out. What happened to those guys when they went to trial?
They're a tribe of twits, we can say that. And they got off. A jury acquitted them of their little stunt from earlier this year. It was like I guess you can call it the 2010 equivalent of the O.J. Simpson case, where it's just the sort of bizarre form of jury nullification. Now, I think there was a report in Think Progress in which one of the jurors said that essentially the prosecutors didn't make their case. But, I mean, what else would – I mean – the case is fairly obvious, but I guess it's one of those things where, again, just like juries in the South back in the 50s and 60s, if the jury has sympathy with the defendants, the juries are going to basically let the defendants walk, as we've seen.
Yeah. And I guess so. I mean, the point of this whole exercise, besides the unbelievable juxtaposition of these two events, where the Native Americans get the heavy-handed treatment and the white guys get to walk free and feel proud of themselves, right? That reflects an underlying attitude, which I think at some level connects back to climate change, right? It is this way of viewing the world where the people that are trying to protect their water are somehow a threat. And these other guys with guns shooting their mouths off are not. They're heroes. That's a threat to the future, I think.
Yes, there was a great piece by Aaron Beatty in the New York, in the Los Angeles Times talking about this. Basically, the whole issue of who gets the gold mine and who gets the shaft, as the old country music song goes, and basically making the point that the protesters in who basically got off at in Oregon, they weren't protesting against something that's considered important. The wildlife refuge, that's not considered an economic powerhouse, but what the Standing Rock Sioux tribe is protesting against, they're protesting against an economic powerhouse. They're protesting against so-called energy independence, and that therefore that protest must necessarily be repressed because God forbid anybody does anything that sort of gets in the way of the building of pipelines. It's like
Just present that for the contemplation of the listening audience, right? If that irony has not struck you yet, that the sagebrush rebellion guys got to walk free and the Indians all got arrested, if that doesn't tell you something or make you think twice, you need to think a little bit more about it. I would suggest you think a tad more about it.
But speaking of
thinking more about things, though, I have to admit myself that the context of the Standing Rock Sioux events, right, are always local, right? The Standing Rock Sioux are trying to protect their water. They're trying to protect their lives, where they are, their locality, right? And it's easy for a guy like me, 2,000 miles away, to say, oh, yeah, this is a climate issue. Oh, they're trying to keep it in the ground, like the newspaper says, the Guardian newspaper wants you to keep it in the ground, and somehow use that as a justification. I saw a blog post. I'll put it on the blog here, but basically saying, please, Mr. Climate Hawk, don't try to co-opt the Standing Rock Sioux opposition to the pipeline, that they are fighting colonial violence, which has for many decades, hundreds of years, been directed at Indians. So they're fighting a fight that has gone on for a long time, and they don't want it necessarily clouded with, while they agree there's a climate context, that's not their primary issue. And did you see anything like that?
Yes, and it's an interesting piece, and it's an interesting argument, although There are two ways of looking at it. Number one, I believe David Archambault, who's the head of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, I recall an interview I think he did with NPR in which he basically made the point that they're not necessarily against the building of the pipeline per se. They just don't want it to threaten their water. So from that perspective, one can understand why people don't necessarily want it to be associated with a climate protest. However, the concept of water being life, and the fact that, fossil fuels threaten life, that does make it a climate-related protest, even if some people object to it being characterized as such. I mean, it is one of those things where everything is, to use the old line from the movie Syriana, ironically enough about the fossil fuel industry, everything is connected. And this is clearly so closely linked to climate that, you can understand why people would recognize this as a climate protest, even if it is not technically one.
So last week, or the show before last, we talked about an article by Ross Gelbspan, who called for climate hawks to become catalysts and facilitators for the aspirations and causes of people around the world that are not necessarily climate issues. And I think this is a perfect case of that, right? I mean, absolutely it is true that both the Standing Rock Sioux and Climate Hawks are in opposition to that pipeline in that place, right? So you're allies. You may have slightly different underlying justifications, but that doesn't mean you're not an ally. And if you recognize and empathize with the intent of your ally, so much the better. I mean, I think that strengthens the movement. So, I mean, for me, the recognition that the fundamental driving force of the Standing Rock Sioux, well, I say this as if I know, but I mean, you know, you potentially, right? The fundamental driver there is the protection of their water supply and the protection of their sacred sites in a fight against colonial oppression, right? Which sounds like so 1960s, right? But still, it's true, right? Colonial oppression. Mm-hmm. I mean, that can still be an ally, and we can still work, we should still work together, because as climate hawks, we oppose the construction of that pipeline in that place. We would oppose the construction of that pipeline in some other place also, but that doesn't, that's not the relevant issue right now. It's this pipeline in this place that we want to stop. And so I think that climate hawks need to find ways to sincerely collaborate and help, basically help the goals of your allies to succeed as well as your own. I mean, I don't know, maybe that's too high-powered.
Actually, it's not because, you know, if you think about it, too, if climate hawks don't stand with the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, who will? Think of all the groups that sort of scorn, all the people that scorn what the Standing Rock Sioux tribe is trying to do. I you see the comparisons between the sort of social scorn directed towards the Black Lives Matter movement. Who's going to stand with the Standing Rock Sioux if climate hawks don't? I mean, I know everybody quotes the Martin Niemöller poem to the extent it becomes a cliche, but think about it. If people don't stay, you know, first they came for the Standing Rock Sioux and we said nothing because we weren't Sioux, and then
they were Black Lives Matter. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, it I think that this comes back to the question of building alliances for a better world. So, which brings me to the last point. We've got all of, let's see, 2.5 minutes left on the clock, DR. But there was an article that I saw in the New York Times that took issue, so it's an op-ed that talks about fighting climate change, calling for a revolution, and not putting the whole world on a war footing, as did Bill McKibben about 2 months ago, right? Basically, it's a discussion of what's the right metaphor for work on climate change. Do you regard it as a war where we're against something and we all have to, I don't know, make sacrifices to succeed? Or it is a, is it a revolution of the way we think about the world, who our allies are, in order to change the world to a better place? So tell me, DR, explain it to me. You got 30 seconds.
It is a great piece by Eric Godoy and Aaron Jaffe discussing the concept of, do we think of a revolution in terms of the way we, you know, rethink our economy and rethink the way our economy is structured to address this issue, and basically making the argument that the war analogy doesn't work. But who knows? Maybe you could say there needs to be a revolutionary war.
I think I heard about one of those. Yeah,
exactly.
Well, I'll try and do is, since we don't have time to put it up and to talk too much, I will put up the two articles side by side in the blog post. If you get a chance, you should ought to read them both and just sort of think about it. I guess I have to admit, I'm not very clear what the most useful metaphor is. But I mean, I would say that even if it turns out that China makes all the solar panels and turns into a clean energy giant for the next century, if we save the planet, that's a good thing. Because in 1,000 years, we'll all be looking back and they won't be able to tell one from the other, right? So the collaborative revolution idea has a lot of appeal. But I don't know. I don't know, DR. Anyway, DR, thank you so much for taking the time to chat.
Thanks.
Let me just tell everybody, we'll put up the links on the blog. You can find us on Facebook at @MassClimateAction. You can listen to us on your smartphone using Stitcher or TuneIn Radio. You can find us on iTunes. We are literally all over the place. We'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. So, DR, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. Talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.